It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A year ago today, a student opened fire at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison, killing a teacher and a 14-year-old student and injuring six others. The attacker died by a self-inflicted gunshot wound. It's the deadliest school shooting in state history.
And since then, there have been at least 75 school shootings across the country, including one at Brown University in Rhode Island on Saturday that left two students dead and nine people injured. Here's Jennifer Ray, principal of Abundant Life, in a video message from last week.
Each individual has a journey, and we continue to press into that journey of trauma and healing. We know it's an individual basis, and we, as a team, we lean into each individual need, and we press into what we value instead of avoiding what is hard. God comforts us so that we can comfort other people, and we're grateful for others that have come alongside us to comfort us.
Weeks after the Abundant Life shooting, Governor Evers established an Office of Violence Prevention to curb gun violence in the state. In just a bit, we'll hear about that office and its work.
But first, we're joined by Janet Hyde, an emeritus professor in the Department of Psychology and Gender and Women's Studies at UW-Madison. She's author of the book, The Psychology of Gun Violence. Janet, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, although it's a sad occasion.
A day like this can be really difficult and distressing for survivors. How might a day like this affect the Abundant Life School community?
Yes, well, the background is that among survivors of school shootings, it's quite common that people get PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, which is quite a debilitating disorder that symptoms are things like flashbacks to the frightening event, panic attacks, hypersensitivity to little cues like a firecracker going off for 4th of July sounds like the gun firing, and all of a sudden they're in a panic. And the people affected are the survivors, the students at the school, the faculty and staff, and the parents, that whole community. So many of them probably do have some symptoms of PTSD. An anniversary like this can reactivate that trauma. And that's one of the problems with it. And this is the cost of unregulated guns in the United States, that these far-reaching psychological consequences.
So should people observe or acknowledge trauma anniversaries?
I don't think they have much choice, but they can use it as a time for healing. And the things, there are multiple things that help people recover in a situation like this. One of those is social support. Mm-hmm. And from everything I've read about Abundant Life Christian School, it's quite a community, and they have really bonded together to offer each other social support. So that's incredibly important. Another thing that we understand from psychology is that one of the things that helps people get past tragedies like this is faith. And this is it's a Christian community at that school. So I'm quite confident that the students and the faculty and the parents have a lot of faith, and that will help them through this. And then I'd also say there's nothing like having a good psychotherapist. And there are many of them in Madison. I have a friend who's a parent in a school shooting. Her kids survived, but she has described in detail the trauma running toward the school, not knowing if it were her kids who were killed. And then she speaks quite movingly of how a psychotherapist helped their whole family to heal. So that's an important thing to remember, too.
I'm wondering what factors might decide whether an event like this can significantly affect a child into adulthood, carrying a trauma with them for a long time.
Well, that's one of the long-term consequences here. And we actually heard this with the mass shooting at Brown University over the weekend. Two of the students there had been in high schools, in shootings in their high schools or middle schools, one of them the Parkland, Florida school shooting. And they spoke of how, talk about reactivating trauma. So we have some very good psychotherapies for this. We can help people get over it. But those are scars, emotional scars that people will carry with them for the rest of their lives. And we know how to prevent these shootings, and we need to get on it. This is too high a price to pay.
Janet, thank you for joining us on this day.
You're welcome.
Janet Hyde is an emeritus professor in the Department of Psychology and Gender and Women's Studies at UW-Madison. Now we turn to Nick Matuszewski, Associate Executive Director of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort. He leads the Wisconsin Gun Violence Prevention Coalition. Nick, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Since the tragedy at Abundant Life, what kinds of new efforts are working to prevent gun violence in Wisconsin schools?
Yeah, I mean, since the shooting last year, we have seen no shortage of really impactful and powerful gun violence prevention, gun safety laws being proposed and bills being introduced in the state legislature. But what we've seen this session, what we've seen in previous sessions, is just that the gun lobby has such a strong impact on some legislators that these bills are not moving. They're not getting hearings. We know that they would save lives, and yet they're not even moving through committees or getting hearings or anything like that. Things like extreme risk laws, universal background checks, these policies pull incredibly well in Wisconsin, and still they don't move forward. The one bright spot that we've seen this year is, as was mentioned, the creation of the statewide Office of Violence Prevention. But even that had so much more potential. You know, the governor put forward a budget in the state budget for that office of $12 million over the next 2 years. And that was taken out of the budget almost immediately. So we're just seeing so much pushback from those that are beholden to the gun lobby on every policy that would reduce gun violence in the state.
The Wisconsin Office of Violence Prevention is coming up on its one-year anniversary next month, and your group had advocated for the creation of this office. What kind of things do you see it being able to do related to these school shootings?
So the office is going to have around $10 million in federal dollars that will have to be spent by the end of 2026. So right now, under the leadership of Amanda Powers, they are really doing a fantastic job of working with groups around the state and, local organizations, statewide organizations, and others who are doing the work on the ground every day to reduce violence in our state, and finding ways to distribute that money to those organizations that need it most. There are just so many organizations throughout Wisconsin that do community violence intervention work, which is working in the communities in the state that are most heavily impacted by gun violence. You know, having local leaders and mentors go into these areas and solve any disputes and work with individuals that might be at the highest risk of perpetrating gun violence. But these programs, although they're super impactful and successful, are also at a high risk of being defunded. So it's really kind of imperative that the Office of Violence Prevention is able to find the work that is happening and find ways to fund it. So our hope is that, they're able to sustain the work that's already happening in the state. And then from there, we're going to have to find other solutions as we move forward past 2026.
At one of my kids' schools, there was a lockdown drill this week. And I'm wondering, do you see these drills happening around the state, and what impact do they have?
Yeah, we see lockdown drills happening, ever more increasingly often. I think that they have an incredibly harmful impact on students. I grew up in an era right before it became super popular to have these drills. But we've seen with younger generations that it's always front of mind for them. And kids who return to school after the summer are often traumatized and worried about going to school and worried about gun violence in their classrooms. And that just wasn't the case when I was going back to school and for so many others. And it's just heartbreaking to know that what should be a safe place for our kids has become somewhere that many of them fear.
This Tragedy at Abundant Life wasn't the only shooting that happened in Wisconsin last year. A 14-year-old student was shot and killed by police after bringing an air rifle to Mount Horeb Middle School. Can you talk about some data here? How often are these events happening in Wisconsin?
Sure. So data around gun violence is sometimes hard to get, you know, the full picture, largely because policymakers have really hampered the efforts to collect data and ensure that we actually know the full picture of what's happening. But nevertheless, efforts have continued to try to have a better understanding of gun violence in Wisconsin and in the country. The most recent data that we have a full picture of is in 2023. And I can say that that year we saw 762 Wisconsinites lose their lives to gun violence. A large percentage of that was through suicide, but you know, also homicides are rising in the state. You know, as every day there are tragedies occurring in Wisconsin around gun violence.
Nick, as we close, I'm wondering if your coalition work is looking at the mental health piece of this, and do you advocate for mental health efforts?
Absolutely. I think it's important for folks to understand that the vast majority of gun violence is not tied to mental health issues. With that said, we fully support funding mental health efforts. We know that it's incredibly important. It's just also important to know that that won't be the only solution. We also have to limit access to firearms, and we have to ensure that we address root causes of violence. So it's often used as a distraction to say, well, let's just worry about mental health and not the guns. I think we have to approach both with equal intensity. Of course, we want to solve the mental health crises, but we have to ensure that firearms are less accessible.
Nick, thank you for joining us. That is Nick Matuszewski, Associate Executive Director of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, leads the Wisconsin Gun Violence Prevention Coalition.
Coming up, cities in Wisconsin are dealing with some wild turkey trouble. We'll find out why the birds get aggressive and check out the state's turkey management plans.
We're absolutely seeing an increase in birds used in these urban areas. We're seeing it all across the state.
That's next here on WPR News. The city of Eau Claire is relocating several aggressive wild turkeys living near a popular trail in the city.
One of those turkeys left a resident with a cut on the hand and a trip to the hospital. And earlier this year, the Appleton area dealt with similar issues.
These cases might be outliers, but they come as the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is updating its wild turkey management plan and asking for public input.
So we're checking in on the state's love-hate relationship with the bird as the winter turkey hunting season nears its end.
Taylor Finger is the game bird specialist for the state DNR. Taylor, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
All right, we've been seeing stories lately about turkeys causing problems in places like Eau Claire and Appleton. Is this something that's becoming more common in recent years, or does it just happen to be we're reporting on it a little more lately?
No, we're absolutely seeing an increase in birds used in these urban areas. We're seeing it all across the state.
What is it that we're seeing more turkeys in these urban areas than we used to, or is there something else that's leading to more conflicts?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of multiple things. We've had really good years the last couple of years in terms of production for turkeys. We really haven't had much for winters, which tend to be one of the controlling factors for the turkey population. So we've had really mild winters. We've had good breeding success. So our turkey numbers are sitting in a really good shape. And then in combination, you know, we keep seeing urban sprawl just grow and grow, and where those two end up meeting, you know, turkeys quickly find out that in urban areas, they have very few predators, and usually there's a lot of bird feeders. And so when that tends to be the case, there's, you know, a lot of food and very few dangerous situations, so they tend to make themselves right at home.
Now, I know I've walked in the woods and stuff by groups of turkeys without any incident at all. Are there, you know, times, places, situations where turkeys are more likely to approach humans and challenge them?
Oh, yeah. Generally in the late winter, early spring, when the toms and jakes start ramping up to getting into their breeding phase, they become considerably more aggressive. And that generally is what we see from these situations, is that it's usually young male birds or adult male birds that are being aggressive towards just about anything as it gets into what they would consider their breeding territory.
Toms and jakes. Toms, I'm thinking, is a guy turkey. Jake is a younger one?
Yep, Tom is an adult male turkey, and a Jake is a young male turkey.
So in that season, is that a better time to say, uh-oh, I see turkeys, they're out on the path, maybe I pick another direction?
Yeah, absolutely. We always encourage folks to let wildlife be wild, so don't try to get as close to them as you can. Don't try and, you know, pull up your camera. I mean, it's nice to get pictures and stuff, but don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to make everyone uncomfortable, including the birds. And if that's usually the case, there's usually some ramifications along with that.
Now, I know with some birds, red-winged blackbirds and others, the problem is if you get too close to their nest when there are eggs in it. Is that also a story for turkeys, or is it really just, hey, we're being tough guys during breeding season?
Yeah, usually it's just the tough guys. For hens, they're really skittish. So if they get bumped off a nest, they tend to run away, and sometimes they'll come back, or sometimes they'll just completely abandon the nest. So they usually want to survive. And so their first reaction is I'm going to get out of here. So yeah, we don't see any real conflict related to hens as it relates to turkeys and people.
Now, for someone in that situation, they come around the corner on a trail or whatever, they're face-to-face with an aggressive turkey, it's displaying, it's coming toward them. Do we have a best practices in this situation?
There's, you know, just, it all depends on who you are. You know, if you're, you know, a bigger person, an adult person, you know, you can try to pretend to be big and be the dominant force there, and usually still back down. But generally, if it's a, you know, an older person or a lady at a grocery store or something along those lines, they're going to see you running away, or, you know, that as the, oh, I'm winning, and they will pursue you. So generally just back up slowly, you know, and don't make any quick movements, and don't try to be the hero.
Now, for management of turkeys, when we're seeing problems with aggression, I imagine a lot of that is in the hands of a local municipality, say. But are there standard practices for, hey, this neighborhood, these turkeys, we're having a lot of trouble, there's a lot of people around, when to relocate those turkeys?
Yeah, so the DNR works with U.S. Department of Ag, Wildlife Services, a federal entity, and then usually works with the local municipality. And it's generally on the local municipality to make the call in terms of what they would like to do. Would they like to relocate those birds? If they want to relocate those birds, they generally have to foot the bill of what it's going to cost to capture, move, and transport those birds. Or the municipality can, they tend to hold, you know, public meetings and things along those lines, and then they'll make a decision on either to keep them and let them go, or, I mean, you know, just let the situation figure itself out, relocate, or they'll have USDA Wildlife Services come in, capture the birds, and generally they euthanize those birds, and then they'll donate them to either food pantries or zoos or big cat rescues, so we're not just landfilling birds.
Now, we like to feed birds a lot in Wisconsin, and I know sometimes a turkey might just happen to come under your feeder and pick up some food. Should we be intentionally feeding birds in our feeding turkeys in our neighborhoods?
We should not be intentionally feeding turkeys. We understand that, you know, everyone likes to see cardinals, or you want to see chickadees or things that are out there. And I mean, which is fine. We have no real concerns with regard to that. However, if you see turkeys that are underneath your feeder consistently, and you're also seeing that those tend to be the birds that are going to cause problems, whether that's roosting on the roof of their houses or chasing people, well, then we would recommend that you pull that food source for a little while with the hopes that eventually those birds will move on and get out of the area, because there's not the food then there to support them.
We're talking about wild turkeys in Wisconsin with DNR game bird specialist Taylor Finger. Now, wild turkeys, they had kind of a fall and rise story, I understand, in Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit about their history of conservation?
Yeah, the turkeys were essentially hunted into, they were extirpated from the state in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And we did numerous reintroduction efforts throughout the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. And again, starting again in the late 70s, early 80s, we traded rough grouse with the state of Missouri for turkeys. And on that last reintroduction effort, along with, you know, department staff, National Wild Turkey Federation, a lot of partners, it worked. As you can see, here we are 50 years down the road, and Wisconsin is probably one of the healthiest turkey populations in the entire country. And so, yeah, it's truly a success story.
And what role do these wild turkeys play in our state's ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean they're one of these keystone species that we've had here in the state for a long time, and you know they're omnivores, so they do help to control our insect and pest populations. They also are a great species for dispersing seeds because they'll feed on a lot of our tree and plant species, and then you know when they defecate, they'll move those seeds around the landscape. And I mean, whether you look at it on the good side or the bad side, they're also everything tastes like turkey. You know, baby turkeys and adult turkeys taste like turkey, so things like to eat them. So they're a good food source for a lot of our other predators, coyotes, bobcats, raptors, things like that.
Humans also like to eat them, no secret there. And we heard from Jeff Pritzel about deer hunting in Wisconsin a few weeks back and a declining number of deer hunters in the state. What does it look like when it comes to wild turkey hunters in Wisconsin?
Fortunately, again, I think it's part of the process that you know, they're still relatively new in terms of their introduction and, you know, their growth. So our turkey hunters are extremely avid. And last year was the highest number of tags that we have sold ever. So there's still, I mean, it's still an extremely popular thing. We don't seem to be seeing the declines like we're seeing in some of our other things, but we really do tightly control the turkey seasons. And so, you know, we still have a draw system, we still have a tag system for that. So there's only a limited number of tags available. So generally, you can keep interest high if you limit opportunity.
The state's turkey management plan is up for an update. No big, massive changes in the works, as I understand it, but what kind of tweaks or changes could be on the table?
Yeah, we're going to be having discussions with all of our partners, the Conservation Congress, Wildlife Federation, National Wild Turkey Federation, every entity, the public. We have a public comment period that is open right now. If you go to the DNR website and type in turkey hunting, you can see there's a link on there to provide comments on what people would like to see. But we don't see a ton of changes on the horizon just because we recently did a survey and we found that roughly 75 to 85% of turkey hunters are satisfied with the way the season is. And if the DNR can get over 70% satisfaction in anything that we do, you don't want to do too much in terms of changing things. But we'll see where we can tweak it and add opportunity without, you know, negatively affecting the population or the hunting experience.
There's another few days left in that public comment period you mentioned. What kind of things do you want to hear from people? Who are you hoping to hear from when it comes to the state's turkey management plan?
Anyone. We want to hear from the hunters. We want to hear just, you know, even from the birders or just people that are interested in Wisconsin's wildlife. We want to just get an idea that this is a resource for everyone. It's not just the hunters. It's not just, you know, the birders. This is something for all people in the state of Wisconsin. So we have a really good plan right now and updating the plan. I think we've done an excellent job over the last 10 years or so. And so, like I said, we're not looking to make a ton of changes. However, we want to make sure that we have a plan that represents what everyone wants.
Hey, what about the bird flu that has hit some domestic and some wild species in the state and, well, everywhere? Are wild turkeys a part of that story?
Yeah, fortunately, we have not had an instance where a wild turkey tested positive here in the state of Wisconsin. And I know we tend to. There's a lot of turkey poultry operations that did get that. However, we don't see turkeys concentrating in high enough levels, and typically the birds that carry bird flu are migratory birds, primarily waterfowl and things along those lines. So we just don't see turkeys come into contact enough with migratory birds at a high enough rate or level that they would be very susceptible. And we haven't seen that to be the case yet here in Wisconsin either.
Taylor, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks to be here.
Taylor Finger is the game bird specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He was with us today to share the latest on the DNR's effort to update the state's turkey management plan. If you've got pictures of turkeys striding about your neighborhood, we'd love to see them. Email them to us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, it's prime time to enjoy outdoor winter activities. Get tips on winter gear and how to make the most of groomed trails with the president of the Madison Nordic Ski Club.
My first piece of advice is to invest in a really great headlamp. And being out there under the stars and the full moon and taking in the trails can be a really magical experience.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin saw its first snowfall this year just after Thanksgiving. And thanks to cold temperatures, most of the state remains covered with snow.
That's a departure from recent years when fluctuating temperatures kept snowpack down. This season, snow is good news for people who thrive on winter recreation. And we heard from one listener in the Northwoods, Mike in Minocqua, who's taking to the trails.
Mike texted, "The recent snowfalls have allowed me to exercise my favorite winter sports again. Cross-country skiing, both classic and skate styles, ski-joring with my dog, and getting my fat bike out with studded tires. Most of the time, I enjoy these activities at Minocqua Winter Park, which hosts them all, plus snowshoe trails."
Thanks for writing in, Mike. To hear more about how this winter's weather is helping out skiers in the state, we're checking in now with Carrie Eaton, president of the Madison Nordic Ski Club. Carrie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Madison area has had some dry, brown winters in recent past. What's been the weather like this season for skiing in southern Wisconsin?
We've been so incredibly lucky to have this much snow this early in the season, especially to have a good snowpack in November, ready for snowshoeing and skiing and seeing everyone out on the trails. Everyone is so thrilled and so happy to just be outside.
What has your club been able to do already this season that it hasn't been able to do in past winters?
I think the big perk is just having groomed and prepared trail for all of our outside winter activities. Our Madnorski Ski Club partners with the City of Madison to groom trails in several of the area city parks. So our volunteers are out there before the sun rises, rolling and track setting for our skiers. We've also established some snowshoe trails to make sure that our walkers are included as well. And to be able to have those activities ready in November for all of our youth programs that are starting up and our adult meetups is just fantastic because we're getting outside on the snow instead of trying to make do on the trails.
Some people using a trail might take the fact that it's groomed for granted. What goes into grooming a trail?
Well, it takes several hours of our volunteer groomers getting out there with snowmobiles and special pull-behind equipment to turn those snowy trails into something that is skiable. They use a roller to pack the snow down, and there's a separate groomer for turning that into a special lane for a kind of cross-country skiing called skate skiing.
That's what I did.
And then we also set tracks for classic skiing.
Okay.
It used to take us about 6 hours to groom the trails at Elver Park in Madison. But now we've upgraded and we have 2 grooming sets. We got a second snowmobile and our groomers can do that in about 3 hours.
Okay.
But often they are up very early in the morning when the temperatures are nice and cold because that's the best way to turn that snow into something that is great for skiing.
The exciting part, there won't be a need for snowmaking machines this season.
Yeah, we still have places in town that make snow, which is great. But I think everyone really likes getting out on that natural snow and being out in the woods, taking in nature, seeing that winter wildlife, and just being part of the Nordic community.
I was on the cross-country ski team in high school, and whenever we would finish either a race or finish practice, it was always dark outside. And I'm wondering, how do you deal with that lack of daylight and still get out and cross-country ski during a busy week?
I think a big part of it is to just overcome that first hurdle and get outside. If you're able to take a break in the middle of the day and take in some of that winter sunlight, that's fantastic. But for a lot of us who work or have school, that can be really tough. My advice is to invest in a really great headlamp. The winter trails actually take on this magical look in the dark, and it can be a lot of fun to be out in the evening after work, skiing underneath a full moon in the trees, hearing the owls, and just being out there with friends and community.
So peaceful, so quiet. It just, I can feel it. I can sense it now. So with the ski club, do you have events or what are you gearing up for?
We've already started all of our juniors programs for middle school and high schoolers. But if there are folks out there who are still interested, you're welcome to join us. We have youth programs for elementary age kids that will be starting up in January. We also run monthly club meetings for all of our members and weekly adult meetups for cross-country skiing. We have a special interest group called Trail Women for women identifying skiers and hikers who are interested in just getting out there on the ski trails and snowshoe trails and being active outdoors. And then in the month of January, we also offer free adult lessons. So if someone is just really interested in taking up cross-country skiing, learning how it's done, those free lessons in January are a great way to get started.
Do you remember how you got started in cross-country skiing and what that was like?
I sort of skied recreationally in high school. It was offered as a physical education class in my high school in Northern Illinois. But, you know, down in Illinois, the snow is kind of touch and go, so I didn't get a lot of skiing done in then. But when I moved to Wisconsin, I just really dove in. There are so many fantastic trails in the Madison area. I did learn to skate ski as an adult, which is quite the challenge. But having a group or a community to lean on and help you learn to do that definitely helps a lot. And since I've taken up the sport, I have actually also gotten into ski racing. So I've done several ski marathons.
A Berkey?
I have raced the full Berkey.
Good for
three
you.
Times.
Wow, that's awesome.
And since my daughter was born, I've switched to the 29-kilometer Cordalopet. And I have now officially done 10 of those. I'll be doing my 11th this February.
That is so fabulous. We're talking about outdoor winter activities with Carrie Eaton, president of the Madison Nordic Ski Club. Carrie, are there other areas of the state that may have either more snow or less snow be better equipped for these winter activities?
Yeah, it's really interesting how the snowfall throughout our state can vary. There have been seasons where our snow is actually better than the snow up north. But there are plenty of really magical places around Wisconsin where you can go ski. Down in southern Wisconsin, there are great public lands with the Ice Age Trail and the Greenbush area for Nordic skiing. You have the Lapham Peak Unit near Milwaukee. And several of our state parks like Governor Dodge and Mirror Lake also have cross-country skiing options in the winter. And if you want to go up north, the options are just unlimited.
How has interest in cross-country skiing changed in recent years within your club and maybe within the community? What have you seen and noticed?
Well, a lot of it tends to follow our snowfall. We see our biggest peaks in membership when we've got good snow on the ground, especially in early December. One of the challenges that cross-country skiing really is facing is climate change. And so those low snow years are really tough on folks who really love to cross-country ski. There are great, you know, options out there with that man-made and artificial snow. And even some of the bigger races have managed to pull off some of their long-distance races using that artificial snow option. But one of the things I really like about our club is our emphasis really is just on being active outdoors, whether it's mountain biking or hiking as a group. We offer a September bike ride that we do as a club where we just bike around. We have group hikes. Just being outside and being active out in nature has a lot of health benefits, not just physical ones, but mental ones too.
That is so awesome. Obviously, the weather, as you mentioned, can really dictate whether someone is getting out or not. On warmer days when there maybe isn't as much snow on the ground, what options do people have to get outside?
Yeah, I mean, just start by going for a brisk walk in your neighborhood. I'm a runner myself, and so I'll get up and go for an early morning run or a trail run at the Pheasant Branch Conservancy right near my home. We have a lot of members who are very interested in biking, and so they take their summer road bikes and turn them into winter fat bikes so they can take on the trails in any condition. Just finding a way to get a little bit of movement through these cold, dark winter months can be really beneficial.
Carrie, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Carrie Eaton is president of the Madison Nordic Ski Club. We've been talking about the widespread snow cover and how our club is getting out to enjoy winter activities and making the trails so other people can get out as well. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Royce Fidesua.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.